Welcome back to the ACRO Files. Our listeners know that the American College of Real Estate Lawyers is a national organization of 1,000 distinguished practitioners fostering the exchange of the most sophisticated ideas and experiences in the development, financing, and investment of real estate. We continue our series of podcasts with leading individuals in commercial real estate who have built the companies that have shaped the industry to share reflections on their careers and predictions for the future. Today, I'm pleased to welcome my good friend, Debbie Harbin, co-founder and co-CEO of Artemis Real Estate Partners. Debbie, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Jay.
Before we chat about your incredible career at Bank of America, JER, and Artemis, let's go back to the beginning and talk a little bit about where you grew up, what influenced you to focus on real estate, and ultimately, how you and Penny Pritzker founded Artemis.
Sure. Okay, I'm going to start where I began, which is I grew up in a very small town in Connecticut. Thank God it's first stoplight when I was in ninth grade. And when I think back about, and reflecting on my kind of early, I guess you could say my upbringing, I had parents that involved me in their work at a very young age. And in retrospect, it has had a profound impact on Artemis. My dad was a successful investment banker, and he would commute in to New York City every day. And when I was 5 years old, he started to take me into his office. And I remember the train ride, and I remember going up Grand Central Station, going up with the Pan Am building at the time. And I would go into his office, and he had built a pretty successful investment banking business. And I would walk in, and all the men had wonderful window offices around the floor. And the women in those days had desks outside those offices, and they would go and get the men the coffee. And I remember my dad would introduce me to people, and oftentimes someone would open a drawer and give me a mint or a lifesaver. And I used to think, wow, this is pretty good. You get to take the train, you come in, you get candy. And if you come to Artemis today, and I think we've built a very family-friendly business, but on Halloween, you'll find 30 kids running around, all dressed up, trick-or-treating in our office and interacting with all of our staff. And in my parents' day, it was unusual, I think, for women to have careers as well. And so my mom was a teacher of drama in the school system, the public school system, but also did community theater. And she started her own business when I was in ninth grade, and an independent theater company in New York City. And she went around the country, and she traveled to regional theater, and she would identify the emerging high potential playwrights and then raise the capital to produce their plays on Broadway. And she was instrumental for some lesser known playwrights, the one who went on to win a trifecta for Driving Miss Daisy, Oscar and a Tony and Academy Award for the movie. And when I think about that as I think back on my career and I think about that as a child, I realize that really must have been the inspiration for Artemis today, that we have a $5 billion emerging manager platform. And what do? We go around the country and we try to identify the highest performing emerging operating partners and often provide them access to institutional capital for the very first time. And so maybe it was my mother who was the inspiration for our Artemis Emerging Manager platform. But
that's a wonderful connection. Great story.
Yeah. And I don't know about you and your parents, but I think when you're fortunate enough to have parents that have, have careers or lives that are characterized by passion and drive and the desire to make a difference, it becomes part of your DNA. And I guess I learned, from my dad, if you love what you do, then it's not work. And I hope that for all of your listeners. But anyway, so that was my, I would say, childhood. I went to Johns Hopkins University, got a master from Wharton. I did not, as you might have said in the beginning, go to Bank of America. I went to Bankers Trust. at the time. Why? Because probably Bank of America had a longer training program and Bankers Trust had the shortest training program on the street. And I was looking to get a set of skills. And so I don't know how much detail you want in the back, but you know, of the back career, but I would say I did the Bankers Trust training program and then went into middle market leverage buyouts. And that was a phenomenal experience because we were financing, you know, aspiring CEOs or entrepreneurs, whether it's the jewelry manufacturing business or the, you know, or an advertising agency or a styrofoam cup manufacturer. And I did that for 3 years and I loved it. And as can happen in very large institutions, bank walked in and told me one day that as much as you like what you do, we're going to send you to Siberia. And that was the real estate division of Bankers Trust. And I think it was perceived that people in real estate didn't really eat with knives and forks in those times. That was in, I don't want to say how far back that was. And I was devastated. And it turns out that sometimes that was a lesson for me that when you're asked to do something you don't want to do, sometimes it can be precisely what you need. And I learned when I moved to real estate something that you know already, or you would know as a lawyer, and that is that real estate was just one, in those days, one big leverage buyout. Real estate was, you financed, you know, as much as you could by debt and guaranteed the rest so you didn't have to put in any equity. And I was exposed to real estate then as really the essence of entrepreneurship. And I loved it. I was went on to become the first, I guess, female managing director at 29 years old at running Bankers Trust real estate division. We had a $3 billion in New York City, $3 billion portfolio. And at that point, Jay, was the late 80s, and I inherited a portfolio that was under, was about to begin to be under, you could see the cracks of significant distress. So I don't know if you want to, if you, I can talk a little bit about that, or I went from Bankers Trust at a time when, you know, the developers I covered were Donald Trump to Paul Reichman, Olympia in New York, to Steve Ross of the Related Company. And it was Steve Ross who actually introduced me to Joe Robert. And
Yeah,
I,
so yeah, so let, yeah, so let's talk about, and I want to come back to that and see what maybe you can talk about similarities of things that you saw back then. But
sure.
yeah, you transitioned and came down to DC to be a critical person and eventually run Joe's company, JER, at a very, I would assume, challenging, stressful time in the market.
100%. It was actually a time when I had been clawing my, what I call clawing my way up to par, trying to make sure that all of these developers in our portfolio at Bankers Trust paid their loans back, to joining what was called at the time Blackstone Robert as the first hire executive hired at in a venture where, believe it or not, in 1991, Blackstone did not have a real estate department. So they took 10% of their private equity other allocation, and they created a venture with J.E. Robert Company. So it was called Blackstone Robert. And I joined to basically build a principal business, principal investing activity for JER. And it was a incredibly difficult time for those who had assets. But if you just had capital, once again, very similar to de today, then it was, if you could raise the capital, an incredible time to be able to buy assets from the RTC. And maybe some people who are listening don't know what the RTC is, which was the Resolution Trust Company in the early 90s. And Joe Robert appropriately predicted that we would experience the largest transfer of wealth from the government to the private sector that had not yet happened. And the RTC had a $90 billion, I believe, inventory of assets. And the J. Robert Company had been managing assets, the largest private manager of those assets. So it was really, on the one hand, it was an opportunity to take this asset manager and transform it to the largest joint venture operating partner with Goldman, Lehman, First Boston in buying these, and as a principal in buying these assets. But on the other hand, I really felt like I was at the top of a high dive at Bankers Trust, and I was about to plunge headfirst into a puddle coming to Washington, D.C. No disrespect to Washington, D.C., but I was, I came grudgingly. It was my husband's turn to move, and he said we would be here for 2 years. And so I thought, well, I'll go back and work at Blackstone if it doesn't, you know, when we come back to Washington, D.C.
Okay. Yeah. And
clearly that didn't happen. We never went back.
Built the company. It was, as I recall, back in the 90s, when 80s and 90s, it was the largest RTC SAMDA contractor. And as you say, lots of people listening to this don't remember those days. But, you know, I have heard several times over the last year or two that as we were going through the latest of the many cycles that you've seen and played a role in, that what was going to be needed to bail out a lot of the current office debt was going to be an RTC type company. Have you thought about that at all, given what you've seen over the years?
Well, look, I thought about that, honestly, multiple times over the last 30 years. I actually thought that we would need an RTC-like or an FDC-like bailout when the great financial crisis hit, and we didn't see that. When Signature Bank failed, I think that we thought might happen again. It's all a function of, I think there will be opportunity to take advantage of failed bank loan sales, and we are definitely positioned to do that. You know, there will also be opportunities to take over failed banks, and we are participating in that activity as well. But I have to say that, if you listen to the Fed, they would say they've stress tested the regional banking system, and they feel that that we will, you know, that the banking system is sound and can absorb whatever comes our way. I think it'll be I don't think there'll be a resolution trust type entity. And I think the amount of dry powder that exists to take advantage of attractively priced assets at a discount coming out of banks, if it's sufficient enough of a discount, I think the private sector will probably be able to absorb, but I think there will be, we'll never have what the RTC had, where we had a 25% discount for cash. I don't know if you remember that, but yeah, those were definitely the good old days. I think there are now, and First Bank and others, the government has evolved and is much more aware of what the appropriate risk sharing should be. And so I think there may be opportunities if rates stay high or rates go higher. But if we have a soft landing, I don't predict that we'll see an RTC-like opportunity.
Okay, great, good, very interesting. So let's go back in the Debbie Harmon story. I think you're at JR, I think, for 10 years. As I recall, you took a little break and did some interesting stuff on your passion in philanthropy and Africa and those kinds of things. And I believe you started Artemis in 2009.
I did. I mean, I love your fast-forwarding history. I was actually at JR for 17 years. And I was president and CIO, but I was there, but at the same time, actually, as I built my family, but did, you know, JR, as you say, was one of the largest private SAMDA contractors, but then we built a business that was to become the largest joint venture operating partner to major financial institutions like Goldman and like Blackstone, and Blackstone was early, and then they went to raise their own fund, real estate fund. But then we went out at JR to raise a series of institutional funds. And raised our first fund, which in those days, that's just what you did. You weren't called an emerging manager or anything. You just got to go out and raise a first fund, and you usually did it pretty quickly. In 2007, when I left JR, I kind of thought I had retired. The real estate markets were at their peak, and so it was a pretty good time to leave. You were right. I thought I was leaving to start my next chapter, which would be philanthropic and political. I wanted to help elect the next president of the United States in 2007. So my dream was that was going to be either the first woman or first African American. And it was an extraordinary year. I had a sabbatical where I really got to do everything I hadn't done before, but that I loved. Spent a lot of time in Africa, joined a board of a great organization called Women for Women International, which you've been very supportive of. Thank you. And as well as did stuff in education. And it was a fantastic year. And then in 2009, you know what happened. The markets crashed, and unfortunately, Joe had gone on to take a fair amount of risk. And so the business at JER really stopped. And a lot of the, I'd left all my majority of my net worth in the company. And so that I couldn't meet my philanthropic dreams without going back to work. And so I really, you're right, it was 2009. It was the darkest of times. It was in the kind of the depths of the great financial crisis. And Alex Gilbert, who's the co-CEO of Artemis today and probably one of the greatest partners I have ever had, he and I worked together at JER for many years, came to me and said, do you want to start a business again? And Penny Pritzker, who I worked with helped on Obama, had also written and said, if you ever want to go into business, happy to do it with you. And I thought long and hard, Jay. The only thing I had not yet done in my career was to start a business from scratch. And I had always wanted to run my own business. But, you know, it takes a tremendous amount of capital and courage to start a real estate company from a blank sheet of paper. And so the courage, honestly, it came from my husband and my daughter and my son. And they really pushed me to do this. And the capital came from my savings and from Penny. And I think it was probably, even though I had already started funds at JR and round tripped them and everything I was doing, I'd already done before. And I was gonna buy distress, which I'd done in the, you know, coming out of the RTC. But it was, I don't want to say near impossible, but it was incredibly challenging. And you know, I'm happy to talk about that or pause and see where you'd like me to take it.
No, I would like, you know, I would, I mean, look, you've built this with Penny and Alex and Amar and this wonderful team you guys have. I've built this amazing company, and we can talk a little bit about that. But I think it's interesting to hear, you know, as you say, you picked up pretty challenging time to start a real estate investment company, private equity company in 2009. And you had a lot of pretty impressive people and brain power there with you and Penny and Alex to get going. But what was your vision for Artemis in 2009?
Okay, the first vision, it grew as success grew. But the vision I had in 2009 was, go out, find some other women-owned real estate private equity companies, get what their lessons learned were, figure out why I couldn't find any women-owned real estate private equity companies. Like, what is it why is this happening? And then go raise two funds. And actually, Penny and I had a partnership term of 6 years. Go raise two funds, make back the net worth that I had lost, and then, you know, go back to making a difference in the world. And that quickly evolved to build when I found that there were no other women-owned real estate private equity firms. And if I didn't do this, then how could the industry change? How would other women or minorities or people that wanted to start their own businesses who needed access to capital, how could I actually not do this? And the vision of Artemis became build the most successful, diverse investment manager that would invest across the risk spectrum, debt and equity, across product type, throughout the cycles, just like we've been doing, focused in the middle market, partnering to, with joint venture operating partners to be their strategic capital provider of choice and their one-stop shop for capital access. Because based on having grown up as an operating partner, that did not exist. And what I wanted to do was fill a need in the industry. And I wanted to be able to provide a, I guess you would call it, Alex and I joke, our first fund was we called it our I forget the kind of it was our prove to everyone what it would be like if we ran the zoo. And we wanted all of the old JR investors to come back and we wanted to perform for them in a way that incorporated all the lessons that we had learned at JR. And so why did that from day one? The vision was, you know, begin with the end in mind, have be committed to succession planning, not have just one person have all the equity and control all the decision making, but instead have a team of partners, build the team where people were at complementary and different perspectives and skill sets. Because I always thought I'd always done that at JR. I thought difference was a strength. And when I went out to raise Artemis Fund One, I realized that actually there's such status quo bias in our industry that difference is viewed as a risk. And that risk is a very challenging to overcome. And when Penny and I first started, we would go out and call investors and we'd look at each other and we'd say the only thing we were emerging at is being emerging, but everybody wanted to put us in this bucket of a small amount of capital allocated to diverse or emerging managers because they were deemed by the industry to be so risky. And so then the vision evolved to disrupt the industry, disrupt that vision, build a business, which we have today of, you know, $5 billion of equity that's investing in diverse and emerging joint venture operating partners across the risk spectrum. And that has, and I've got to be careful like talking about performance, but it continues to grow and it has been very successful. And
Right.
we wanted to bust the myth. And there are a lot of myths about, you know, investing with first-time firms or first-time funds. And hopefully we will have accomplished that.
Talk about, so I've heard you talk about how many, a couple of hundred meetings it took to get your first fund raised, but
Yeah.
know, and it was, you know, it was difficult time, and as you say, fighting against the status quo. We've got a lot of women listeners on this podcast in the college and otherwise. Talk about what the challenges were because it was you and Penny going out there in this woman-owned company, notwithstanding your own accomplishments and Penny's, of course. And how did that play out? Was it helpful sometimes, or was it more you were hurtful and having to sort of claw your way up and convince people of your credibility?
Yeah, I would say it was surprising. We thought that we had, you imagine that it's we're not thinking we're a first-time fund because I had already round-tripped two funds, same strategy, and exceeded the target returns, and the funds have been realized. So JR Fund One and JR Fund Two, the US portion of that. And so I thought, well, this is going to be easy. I did think back and say, you know, when we, you know, there must be a reason that this hasn't been done before. So let's build a first-time fund model that is meets every lesson learned that Penny and I heard from investors when we did our listening tour in 6 months before we started Artemis. And so I said, we need to be the largest GP investor in our own fund. So we put up 50, we were prepared to put up $50 million of equity. We committed to that at not over time, but like as a first investor. And we said, so we'll be the largest investor in our own fund. We'll target a $300 million fund, and we'll commit to be a $50 million investor in our second fund, and we'll give all those first investors the first right to go into our second fund. So we thought, we know that investors, may be worried that we're not going to be as committed in the second fund. And so we tried to think of every reason that someone would have to turn us down. So then we said, we're gonna commit the seed equity to build out the team before we have a first investor. No one does that. And so we had a team of people that had worked together before. And I had learned from the great financial crisis that and I told all the investors, I will not commit a dime of your capital and on my capital until I knew, I felt it was going to be Alex Gilbert was on board, but they didn't know who it was. But till there was a president who could solely focus on investments, because I felt that up until the crisis, there were CEOs that did both capital raising and investing and ran the business, and I saw how hard that was going through the crisis, and I felt that you needed to really go deeper and longer on senior level talent if you're going to ask institutional investors to take a quote operating risk. And so we went through, every possible risk we thought that investors might say or questions they might ask, and we will serve up an opportunity that couldn't be refused. And as you say, 225 meetings later, 2 years later, we found 11 brave investors. And I always say opportunity favors the brave. And they were extraordinary. I have like they were stakeholders truly in our success. I used to call them our lifeblood, because without them, we would have never gotten started. And today we have $10 billion of assets, and we have a 95% re-up rate of our investors across our platform, which was, I think, a part of an early vision that Alex and I had, which is we wanted to reward the investors that came in with us early and to be able to continue to perform across the different vehicles that we ended up building. And so I would say that someone said to me very early on, who had raised a first-time fund, he said, "Deb, the greatest thing about raising a first-time fund is if you're successful, you'll never have to be a first-time fund again." And that might be true within that vehicle, not so true if you're building different other business lines. When we went out to raise our fund two, it took 4 months, and we had a 100% re-up rate. And so it was as hard as fund one was, fund two really was a joy. And I think we actually increased our fees. So that was something that never happened. And in our fund three, was very successful as well. And that led to our most recent fund, which was just won the fundraising of the year award last week, for our fund four. So,
it's obviously a great story. You've raised capital, as you don't need me to tell you, across lots of different risk profiles, from distressed to core and core plus. I know that for you personally, and I think for the company, that investing in the communities, and maybe before it was termed back when you started social impact type investing, is part of the DNA, I think, of what you've done. So talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I would say that when I want to go back to your question, when you said, what was your vision? I remember sitting with Penny, and she asked me that same question. And I said, I want to build a business that does well and does good. And that became very commonly said after a while. But I wanted to build a business that was a force multiplier of performance and purpose. And that was incredibly important to me. And that is part of our DNA. And so I will talk a little bit about how it plays out inside the company and in our business lines, but then also, externally. And so we realized what after our fund one that if it was so hard for two people towards the middle of their career to do that, who had the fortunately had Penny as a partner, had the capital put up at such a sizable GP commitment, what happens to every other woman or minority or startup man who wants to do this and doesn't have a penny or is doing this at a much younger stage in their career? And so we decided to actually we pitched New York Common to come into our fund. They passed. They were overexposed to opportunistic investing, but they came back to us and said, "Well, tell us what you would do if we asked you to submit a proposal for an emerging manager program." And that I started to study the emerging manager business, and I learned because I never knew the term before that actually. I felt the industry was looking at emerging managers in totally the wrong way. And they were saying, because you're different, because you're new, you're greater risk. So we're going to push you out on the risk spectrum and we're going to tell you to go develop in Harlem or Anacostia or to take greater risk. And then a cycle will hit. And then because they've taken greater risk and the cycle hits, they're disproportionately impacted. And then everybody decides this is why you shouldn't invest with women and minorities because they're too risky. So I was like, no, that doesn't make sense. Let's actually build a business that takes core plus risk on stabilized assets and helps it helps instead of forcing the operating partner to sell their opportunistic value created asset, why don't we recapitalize those operating partners on assets that they already own, control, know? They can keep their leasing, their management, and their fee stream. And let's do everything we can to support them. Some early stage, we would incubate, give office space, share, they can share our office space, they can share our models, they can let's introduce the more later stage ones to our capital partners. Let's take a venture capital approach to establishing an emerging manager platform that didn't exist before and take less risk on the asset and more risk on the manager. And but Artemis would invest in every deal. Artemis would tell the capital, we will take over basically at no cost if there's a problem. We will be your outsourced staff. And we have now today 100 people that are across the country that can partner with local sharpshooting experts in the smaller size transactions, which was a whole market universe that was under the radar screen of the larger institutional partners. And New York Common had courage and had they believed deeply that diversity improved the bottom line. That was Controller DiNapoli's quote. And they gave us the opportunity to perform. And that program has evolved in a multitude of ways. And as I said, now $5 billion of capital across many, many institutions, whether it's New York Common, New York City, Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, all of the leaders in advancing institutional access to capital for those that have been underrepresented in the real estate ecosystem. And they were tremendous. And then with that capital comes a responsibility to reach back and pay forward. And so we do that by walking the talk at Artemis. Artemis today, top to bottom, is 50%, 50, 55% women and minorities from the senior leadership down to the entry level. We created a summer enrichment training program for kids that, unlike, my children who had access to opportunity because of their because of their environment. Well, there's their talent isn't evenly distributed. It is talent exists in zip codes that don't have access to opportunity. And we have a responsibility if we have access to capital, and especially for the institutional shareholders. I look at them as shareholders in Artemis, even though they're institutional investors. We share their mission that they would like their capital to be managed by people that look like they're beneficiaries. So how do we do that? Well, we have to open the talent pipeline and expand access to opportunity. And so we created a summer enrichment program that has taken, you know, we have more interns than we do people in our company some summers. And 80% are underrepresented and would not have ever had access to opportunities in real estate, but for through this program. And the program isn't to come work at Artemis. The program is expose them to all aspects of real estate, law, you should get involved, or architecture or investment. We do it with a number of our joint venture operating partners. We have tremendous partners in DC, Washington, DC, that have helped us. And so that is something that the whole firm gets involved in. July is dedicated to that. And I'm extremely proud. More than half of the summer interns have gone on to get jobs in real estate. And that program became the pilot for something that's called the PREA Foundation, which has raised now is an industry nationwide partnership that is basically it's the leading talent development pathway for diverse and underrepresented young people into the real estate industry. And they do that through partnering with something called SEO, Urban Alliance, Twego, Girls Who Invest. And we being the PREA Foundation, brings, you know, provides capital from the real estate industry, from all the leaders in the real estate industry, their firms, to provide training and internship and jobs. And so I am incredibly proud of what Artemis did at the beginning, you know, from a little seed, a mighty oak will grow. And that, and I would say the PREA Foundation and what the industry has done now. If I could have had a legacy or Jay or a vision, if I really knew what I had the potential to do with the capital that our partners have entrusted us with, it would have been to, you know, diversify our industry and help change the face of the industry.
Well, it is indeed a wonderful and inspiring story to listen to. I will never forget at your 10th anniversary dinner, Penny's comment about how you and she sat down and reflected on all these things you've been talking about, and how she, when she said that night, culture beats strategy every time when you're trying to build the company. And it's quite obvious that you and your team have built this amazing culture and have had a real impact on not just, you know, real estate investors, but on the people around you. And as you say, and as you probably know, you've been a great supporter of higher achievement. One of our bylines at Higher Achievement is talent is everywhere and opportunity is not.
Right.
So
I
it's
totally
just
agree.
great. So let's just, before we run out of time, you mentioned PREA a couple of times, and for those who don't know, it's the Pension Real Estate Association. And I know you chaired the association for a while. Talk a little bit in sort of reflecting and guidance to people about the importance of being involved in those kinds of organizations. You were involved in UI very much and in PREA. And why is that important for people as they are coming up through their careers, and what the benefits people can get out of those kinds of associations that you and I have both been involved in?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I would encourage everyone listening, whether they're regardless of the stage of their career, to be really intentional about building your network of relationships outside of your firm. I think it's pretty natural to do within your organization, but and you can, one of the ways to do that is by being intentional, as Jay said, about joining industry organizations. I say all the time, look, be the change you want to see, right? Look and say, wow, you know, I don't see, I'm looking at the top of my organization and I don't see very many people that look like me. And I would like to change, I'd like to make that different. Well, you know, get involved, whether it's in the Pension Real Estate Association, which is the on the institutional investor side and GP side, or it's at ULI, or it's with any of their so many higher achievements, so many terrific organizations. why you should do that. A, because it makes you feel a lot better about yourself, hopefully. B, you know, to whom opportunity is given, you have a responsibility to provide that opportunity for others. And so I just believe that just from a human perspective. But I think that I only realized later when I started Artemis, and people began to invite me into less formal networks, but more informal forums and groups and roundtables and different kinds of things that had been around for 20 years. But frankly, most of them had been groups of men. And when I was fortunate enough to be included, I saw the tremendous, tremendous power of these networks, that these guys had been doing deals together, helping each other look at risks in different markets and different opportunities and going on vacations and building lives together. And honestly, as a person in real estate, as a woman, I didn't have those kind of networks. And I came back actually and asked, you know, my young people here, I'm like, I will pay for it. Anytime you want to do a skiers trip, you want to do a skiers roundtable, you want to do this or that, 50-50 men and women. You know, start forming groups if you want. You know, you don't have to wait to be invited. I should have formed something, you know, decades before. And I just hadn't been exposed to it. And I think, depending on if they're younger people listening, I mean, I think, you know, looking at Jay, I mean, I have actually found that my greatest mentors were my lawyers. I mean, I didn't know you when I was 25, but I did meet Marty Edelman, who was the first lawyer on the first equity deal I ever did with Related Company. And he was, you know, he was so extraordinary, and he invited, you know, he facilitated my first board ever on Avis Rental, you know, car company. I was 37 years old, but he felt that I should have corporate board experience outside my industry. He went on to chair, you know, Artemis's advisory board, been with me every step of the way. Another person that opened up massive network for me was a banker, you know, Pat Goldstein. For those of you who remember, she was at Olympia in York, and I went, you know, begging for a chance to finance something. And she, you know, gave me 48 hours to get a term sheet on her desk for a $400 million deal. And she gave me an opening and credibility when I took over the first, you know, as the first team leader in 26 years old. And she did that for me, and sadly was tragically killed, but I mentor her daughter, right? So you have to look, whether it's on a micro scale or a macro scale, I think that mentors and sponsors and these kind of organizations that give you network lead to future opportunities. And they've been enormously impactful for me, because you don't really realize how alone you are until you positively experience these networks. So I would encourage everyone to be intentional and thoughtful about it. And so I think it's a great question.
So that's a great answer. So we could go on. I could go on asking you questions for the next three episodes of this, but I don't want to take too much more of your time. So let me just ask you one or two final questions before we let you go.
Okay.
You've seen it from every possible side, fundraising side, deal side, banking side, and all these things that you've done over the years. You talked in the beginning about the amazing role models you had in your mom and your dad. And of course, your many listeners here know that your brother is incredibly successful in the business as well. What do you think is the best deal kind of business advice that you've ever got?
The best deal business advice. I guess I would say It's broader than deal, but it applies to deal. I would say, so I'm gonna give you three because I can't do the best,
Yeah,
but
that's okay.
I would say one is encourage diversity of thought around an investment. Challenge, make sure there are many as many you encourage as many people to take the other side of an investment decision or a transaction decision. Empower your team. There are many teams in real estate where the CEO decides what you're going to do and everybody executes. I think that it's my experience has been empower your team to challenge, you and your assumptions and encourage them to think creatively, and that's going to foster better risk-adjusted returns. I would also say, I used to say, that's why I was pausing, that sponsorship is everything, and that you can do a bad deal with a good partner and still get a decent result. Today, I would say, you're seeing more strong sponsors defaulting or giving back keys or whatever in groups that you never thought would. And I think that it's a reminder that structure, is now equally important to sponsorship. That's a little bit more of a current evolving nugget of wisdom. I would say that maybe one last one is don't confuse low interest rates or declining cap rates with investment acumen.
Great. Okay, last question. As you reflect back on your amazing career and many accomplishments, what would you tell your 25-year-old self today?
Don't fear failure. Take more risk earlier. Don't let perfection be the enemy of the good.
Terrific.
And
You have one more you want to add?
no, well, I'm trying to say you keep asking me for one thing and I keep giving you three, so I've decided to
That's
stop.
okay. I'm not. That's okay. I'm flexible. It's great. Look, Debbie, this has been just wonderful, really interesting, insightful, and a great reflection of everything you and your partners and you have accomplished for you and your family and everything. So I really appreciate you're taking the time to do this, and we thank you very much for sharing your perspectives and thoughts with the college and everybody else who will get to listen to this.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you for what you do, and thank you for all the support of Artemis as well. You have been a tremendous friend, and I am most grateful.
Thanks, Debbie.
Take care. Bye.